radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Space is a place that only a human being locates. Where there's so much information to take, then you enter an entirely new place. Once you get off the internet, become World Wide Web.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanley, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary, on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is the place. Yeah, be selective, be objective, be an asset to the collective. You know you gotta get alive.
Professor Griff. You're listening to Junior Ricardo Stanton. Straight up, we're teaching you all those things you need to know from the neck up, all right? We're definitely doing a checkup from the neck up. This is Professor Griff from Public Enemy, the ex-minister. I'm out. Peace.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. My name is Junius Ricardo Stanton. We welcome you into today's program. We started off the program with our message in the music, Soul to Soul, Get a Life. And that's an apt beginning for today's program, as our guest, Stanley Ash, has written a book entitled Life Lessons on Becoming a Young Man. It describes some of his life lessons growing up in New York City, and he passes on these lessons to his readers. We will speak with him following these messages. Don't go anywhere. You're logged on to the Cyberspace Sanctuary here on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. We'll be right back.
Greetings to the Internet Radio family. This is Reverend Valentine speaking. You know, for nearly 30 years, I have had the distinct experience of being interviewed over every medium of communication available to the public. And except for the metaphysical underground, I can think of no other electronic venue that has been more progressive, more innovative, more insightful, more diligent, more diverse in its demographics, and more courageously supportive of the truth than this ever-growing phenomenon called Internet radio. And this is precisely why I'm here to tell you that it is so vital that you give your wholehearted support to it. Tell a friend. In fact, tell 2, 3, and 4 of your friends. If you are a business owner, support Internet radio by telling your customers and constituents all about it. Let them know that there is a legitimate and important substitute to all of the prefabricated, super-censored garbage polluting our public airways today. Don't allow the mass media to continue to treat you like a mindless consumer drone. Enhance your awareness. Indulge your critical thinking, your reasoning, and your analysis. Do as I do. Log on, listen in, and then let it be known all about your internet radio experience. Chimatep, beloved family, thank you for listening. Walk in light.
Hi, I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to join me in financially supporting the Blake Radio Network on a regular basis. We need your continuing patronage to help the Blake Radio Network remain alive and thriving both now and well into the future. There are several easy ways you can send your contribution. To use PayPal, click on the help link on the Blake Radio Network's website at www.blakeradio.com, or you can go directly to the PayPal website and click the send money link. Type in rainbowsoul@blakeradio.com as the email address and Unlimited Ventures as the payee. Then follow the instructions. To send a check or money order, make it out to Unlimited Ventures, care of Neil Blake, and mail it to 73 Ireland Place, that's Ireland Place, Suite 109, Amityville, Amityville, New York, 11701. It's easy, painless, and uncomplicated. And you'll feel great after doing it, knowing you're keeping the Blake Radio Network alive and on the cutting edge of media technology. I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, thanking you in advance for your support.
Hotep, my name is Renoka Rashidi. I'm an avid fan of and a big supporter of Brother Junius Stanton.
Our guest on today's program is Stanley Ash, who's a retired educator, a former athletic director, and he's now the author of a book entitled Life Lessons on Becoming a Young Man. Just some background, he was born and raised in New York City in the Bronx,
and we'll let him tell more about his family and upbringing. Welcome, brother. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. I had the opportunity to meet you at a fundraiser, a walk-a-thon, this past fall, and your daughter and you and was one of the sponsors, but you and your family were intricately involved in it. My wife met you on another occasion. She told me about your book. So share your background and your experiences with our listeners growing up in New York City.
Well, I was born and raised in the Bronx, which is one of the boroughs of New York City. And my early years were spent in the projects, which I was later to find out became somewhat famous because it was the first projects built in the Bronx, the Forest Projects. We spent a number of years there, and then when we eventually left the projects, we went to another section of the Bronx. Which prior to that, I thought that the projects, to me, always seemed very special, and I never had heard of any of the negative things they talked about later in life about the projects.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got the chance to see the negative side of New York when we went to another section of South Bronx, a place called Menford Place, a little two-block stretch of land where everything pretty much was out of order there.
Mm-hmm.
It was all of the things that I heard, the negative things I've heard people talk about New York outside of the region. As a matter of fact, former President Carter, who came there, described the area as a DMZ, a demilitarized
war zone.
I never appreciated the comment, but once I went to college and came home and looked at it, I said, okay, I understand what he saw then.
Mm-hmm. Now, you grew up in an intact family. You had siblings. How many siblings did you have?
Three brothers and one sister.
Now, growing up in your first...
My biological mother actually passed away in 1956, and my father remarried within that same year. He realized that he had a need for a woman to help him raise
mm-hmm.
his kids. There were five of us, and he was directed by a friend to leave the country and go to the island of Jamaica because, according to him, the best mothers or the best women who could take care of home were to be found in Jamaica. And it sounded good to my father, so he packed up and took a trip to Jamaica.
How long did he stay
in
Jamaica?
He stayed about a month.
So he went down, did he have relatives, friends, or
no.
did he just went down sight unseen?
He went down there to get a wife. That was his sole purpose.
Mm.
He had been given directions. He had been given two names, two available women, and he went down there in pursuit. I don't know many other men who could have done something as bizarre as that. It's reminiscent of the old frontier days when they had mail order brides. But he felt quite comfortable doing that, so he traveled to Jamaica, and he called us when he had made a decision and told us that he was bringing us home a mother.
Now, how old were you then at that time?
6 and a half.
Mm-hmm. You stayed with grandparents? Or how did you survive once your father left and went down there?
Well, what they did, because I had nothing to do with it, the family stepped in, and we had a series of rotating parents in there. We had a number of cousins, women who came in and took turns running the house.
Mm-hmm.
As you can imagine, it was certainly in disarray after a while. But we had at least three different perspectives on how the house was supposed to run. And my oldest sister, or my sister who was at that time 16, she attempted to assume the role of being mother. And you had her idea of playing mother versus my various cousins who came in, so that certainly didn't work out too well.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, how did that work out? Did you
follow
her lead, or were you in rebellion, or kind of indifferent to
all? Well, I was the youngest, so I received most of my instructions from my older brothers.
Mm-hmm.
They pretty much dictated the way it was going to go, and if I didn't know, I followed whatever they did.
Now, when you lived in the first housing project, and you said it was one of the first that was built in the Bronx, so it
yeah.
was somewhat scenic, or was it a high-rise, was it a low-rise?
Well, at the time, it was called a high-rise, but fast-forward 10 years later, is considered to be one of the smallest projects in probably in all of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
The tallest building there at that time was 14 stories high. And we lived in one of the shorter ones, which was 9 stories high. From that time on, they never built another project that small or that low. Everything went on up until they got to Co-op City, which is still in existence, up in all the way up in Bronx, somewhere near Mount Vernon, I believe.
And
32 floors, I believe. So that became more or less the standard. Everything had to go above 20 or 25 floors.
Mm-hmm. Now, from reading your book, you kind of self-depreciating, you say that you really weren't that into school. So what kept your interest and your attention when you were growing up and coming into adolescence?
It kept my attention as far as even considering school or just...
You know, what was your prime focus? Was it athletics, just hanging out with the girls, what?
The girls played a role, but at the same time, I mentioned earlier, I took a lot of my directions from two of my older brothers, because as far as I was concerned, they did a little bit of everything that I ever considered doing, from criminal, it was probably on the verge of being criminal activities. One of them loved to fight, and he loved the street life. So he spent most of his time fighting and or gambling. He was a gambler. Most folks that could go all night and gamble. And the other one was the lover. So he inspired me as to how to approach girls and learning how to dance. I learned a lot of things from watching him, listening to him. And then he also inspired me when time came how to fight. And I think one of the parts mentioned in my book was how he would take me out in the hallway and we'd do the a miniature exam into moving in towards manhood where we'd exchange punch for punch. And it's one of those activities where most mothers hate it because somebody definitely gets hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But he introduced that idea to me, how that works. And he had a way at that time of pumping me up and just telling me, it looks like I'm ready. I've been lifting weights. You look like you're getting strong. You think you're ready? And then he would even tell me, he said, yeah, I think you're ready. You look like you could go. And we'd go out in the hallway, and then we'd exchange body blows. It's one for one, chest to chest. He gets one, I get one. And we keep going until someone says, that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it paid big dividends because you consider the fact that it was the only safe place to get hit. Because you knew that you could always quit if it got too rough. So that was a prelude to being out in the street and getting in a fight, and you knew what a punch felt like, and especially for my older brother.
So how did that carry over? Did you get respect because you had older brothers in the neighborhood, and when you went, you navigated back and forth to school, that sort of kept the bullies and the thugs off of you?
Yeah, it did that. By way of informing you directly and indirectly that, okay, you can take a punch, and you've been punched enough. So it's not like a fight would be something totally new because you know what it's going to feel like when you get hit, and you got hit by someone who's older, who could hit harder. So you were not fearful of the possible outcome if you got in a fight. And you knew that this idea of getting hit, because most young fellows don't get hit unless they're involved in some sort of activity with other males, and typically they're your age, so they're not going to hit as hard as an older brother. And my brother enjoyed schooling me, so to speak, and so he didn't hold back. When he hit me, he hit me.
Mm.
And so I knew I was hit. And on one occasion, I think I mentioned in the book, he hit me so hard, you know, I almost dropped to my knees, and my mother, fortunately, my mother came out in the hallway, and she said, stop it. And, you know, my reaction was, you heard what Mom said, she said, stop it. And I really felt good getting back then, because I had to go away and recuperate after that. Like I said, he didn't hold back.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like he was going to hit you lighter because you were his brother. He gave you a real example of what you want to get if you get out there and decide that you want to have some sort of confrontation with someone.
Mm. So with your peers, because in the book, and we'll get to this a little later, you learn from your brothers, particularly one of them, how to size people up and a lot about human nature. So how did you make out you know, within your peer group? Were you like the leader? Were you a hangers-on or one of the person like your brother called them wannabes? Or did you have your own guy group of guys that y'all were pretty cool or viewed as cool around the school?
Well, I had a group. I did it both ways. I tried it with groups, and I think I actually wrote that story. I didn't include it in the book. But there were there was an occasion when I used to travel with about 12 guys, and there was a certain degree of comfort in traveling with a group that large. But then the trade-off was we actually couldn't get in any party. And so I had to change that up, because when you went to someone's house, if they invited you, in most cases, they didn't want you to bring along 11 other guys with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I stopped that, and I went did it the reverse way. I started traveling by myself. And with the training that my brothers gave me, I had no problem with going into neighborhoods. Well, I should have, but I didn't. I had no problem with going into neighborhoods where I actually didn't know anyone, which it takes a different mindset when you walk into a neighborhood and you don't know anyone and you go into a party. It's nice not to have any fear, but at the same time, it's a bit foolish, too, because there's many of young African-American men who never come out of those neighborhoods from doing such foolish things. But I tried that, too, and I survived that, you know, going to parties by myself and leaving by myself and making it home safe.
Did you grow up at a time when the girl was having a party, her father would be there scrutinizing the people that came in and making sure that every now and then they come down and click on the lights or something like that?
Oh, yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. The one instance I talked about in the book, I believe, was going to a party, and that was one occasion when I went by myself, and I saw the downside of that. I got caught up. I got in there, and the number one rule back then was if a girl's giving the party, she has to invite the young men from the neighborhood. That was a no-no. If you had a party and even if she didn't like them, she was supposed to invite them. And that one occasion, the story of David, she chose not to invite any of them. And I got there. I didn't know that until somewhere, I guess around 11 o'clock, we found out that the young men weren't invited from the neighborhood. So their reaction was they wanted to hurt somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were hurt any of the brothers they caught coming out of there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when I met David, as a matter of fact. You know, we had to form some sort of unified group, the two of us, realizing that by ourselves, we probably might not get home that night. You know, so, I mean, you had parents here, but for some reason, her people were not there. And we thought, as young men, we thought that was a good idea. With no parents, we would have a good time, you know. When the slow records came on, it was going to be nice. But then all of a sudden, when we heard these guys outside said, yeah, y'all come on down here. When y'all finish partying, come on down here. We got something for you. And at that point in time, I knew the game of numbers, and my brother had reasonably schooled me on, look, you shouldn't be out there by yourself, but if you are, make sure you find somebody that's going to have your back and you have their back. And at least if there are two of y'all, you got a better chance of surviving whatever's coming your way.
Now, you grew up during the Vietnam War era. That posed somewhat of a dilemma to you in terms of what your future was going to be after high school. You talk about in the book how one of your guidance counselors offered you an opportunity or showed you an opportunity where you could leave and go away to college. Had you planned to attend college?
Probably no more than any other African-American youth at that time, where if someone asked you, what do you plan to do, and you say, well, I plan to go to college. It always sounded good.
Mm-hmm.
Always sounded good. It started and ended the conversation right there.
Mm-hmm.
It said, oh, you want to get a college education. Like a lot of guys at that time, I didn't know what I was going to get from it. And it's like my father had said one time, you know, his education was limited to sixth grade. And he always said we should go to college because he didn't know what it was special about the college. He said he knew one thing, that people that come out of college seem to make more money than people who don't go to college.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your father was from the South then, right?
I'm sorry. Yeah, he was from Georgia, a little small town called Montezuma. I visited there a few times since he's passed. And it's right down, it's if you're familiar with Georgia, it's actually 75 miles south of Macon. Macon is in a section they call Middle Georgia. But, you know, he had a sixth grade education. He was proud of it. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, because back then that was good. You know, a lot of them didn't go past maybe the third grade because they had to work.
Oh, no, yeah. So he would very proudly mention it to everybody he would meet that, you know, he had a sixth grade education. And a lot of men that he knew back then, that you're right, they didn't have that. They just talked about they had some schooling.
Yeah, because they couldn't go to school all year round anyway because they had to come out
during
the planting season or the harvest season. You know.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because of a counselor, you ended up in Nebraska. So how does a young African-American male, late adolescence, go from urban and urbane New York City out to Nebraska, where you consider it, you say that it's kind of isolated and rural. So how did you make it out there, and your dad gave you a one-way ticket?
It's a series of circumstances, as they refer to them now, as the perfect storm. All these things came together at one time, and that's how I ended up there. One of the things was it was a Vietnamese war, or the Vietnam War. And at that time, they were still drafting young men into the armed forces. Another factor involved was the stories that came back from my brother's generation were telling us about how terrible it was over there, and they were using real bullets, and people that they knew were dying, and the ones that didn't die were actually shooting each other so they could come home. So if you imagine I'm coming out of high school, 17, 18 years old, and you're telling me about some guys that are so terrible that they're shooting each other so they can get a trip home. And then the other thing came up where they said, okay, if you go to school, you won't have to go in the armed forces. So we went to apply for school in New York City. And the oddest thing you can imagine happened, at that time, New York City had this thing where you could not even go to college in New York if you didn't have a B average. It seems far-fetched now, but no one in New York could get into college without a B average. So to me, it was discriminatory, and that meant a whole lot of black men lost out on the opportunity to go to college. Now, this was September of 67. Now, meanwhile, I said, look, I got to get in school. I went and approached one of my counselors, Mr. Snyder, as a matter of fact, and he said, well, if you really want to go, they got this situation that you can put into computers, of all things, back in 67. It cost $25, and this company said they would find a place that would accept you based on your credentials. And they got back to me the same time that the United States Armed Forces sent me a letter. Uh-huh. It was almost an identical week. And so my choices were getting very limited. When you got that letter from the armed forces and they said, kindly report to your local recruiting office, it was almost a done deal. And the only thing you could do then, perhaps you could drop your knees and pray if you thought that would give you a shot, but most of us didn't think that would happen. So when I got the letter from this agency and they said, okay, we have three schools, it came like one letter came one day, then a few days later another letter came. First they said they have three schools that I can choose from. One was in Texas, one was in Illinois, and one was in Nebraska. And my family was happy that we had these choices. And then the next letter came from the armed forces telling me to report to the draft office. And then the next letter came from the same agency and said, look, okay, we've got word, Doane College in Crete, Nebraska, said they will accept you. And so as far as I was concerned, there was no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Doane College, that was it. Had I been there before? No. Do I know anyone? No. And I was told later that the other factor was that people in New York are not afraid to try new things. So when it came up, I had no consideration of staying home. It was college. Didn't know much about it. I got accepted. I never thought that would happen with the credentials I had. You know, my credentials said that if you're having a party, you want this guy to come, you know. That was about it. Nothing said anything about academically, he's got a shot to succeed. No. So when Doane College said yes, I said, I'm going to Doane College. And then I guess the last part of it that inspired me was we went to the airport. You know, it was a very quiet, long ride because we didn't have a car. So we took a taxi to the airport, which another thing that seems kind of strange now. Someone would get into a taxi and ride for over an hour. I don't remember what the bill was. That might be why my father was so quiet. He was thinking about what it was going to cost. But we went to the airport, and then he announced and pronounced me with a ticket. It was a very memorable occasion. I mean, I never received anything that had such a profound impact on my life as much as that ticket did. He didn't have to say a word. He gave me that ticket. I looked at it. I looked at him, and I was really tempted to say, what in the world is this? There's something wrong with this ticket. But the ticket was a one-way ticket. But I think it said it said all it needed to say.
Yeah.
A one-way ticket. I mean, he wasn't smiling, and neither was I.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, when you finish the task at hand, call me. And the rest of it he didn't have to say, and that was, if you don't finish,
don't call me.
Don't call me.
Right.
And I tell young folks what it would probably be a good lesson if more of them were told that from this immediate area, from Camden area, because a lot of our young men have left and went away to school and didn't make it a semester. For some unbeknownst reason, they packed up and came home. Somebody didn't like them. They didn't like the weather. They didn't like the nationalities of the people. They got homesick, a whole list of reasons. And I tell them, I went through all of that. But I never had anyone on the other end of that phone say, well, come on home. The things I got or were told to me were, are you finished? How long is the semester? Okay, call me when the semester's over. But a lot of our parents, as far as I'm concerned, they spoil the kids. You know, the kids got an option. I said, we didn't have an option. When I went there, I was considered to be the chosen one. So, I mean, it wasn't any question as to whether I was going to stay.
Well,
the only thing I could watch was the calendar to say when the semester was over.
Mm-hmm. So how did you make the adjustment? Were there any people like yourself that you could relate to that maybe, say, came from Chicago or some other city?
They were there. We're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
When I got out there, we had some of the folks who weren't totally thugs. And I think that's what the school ended up with. They ended up with brothers who were on the outer fringes of almost crossing that line to do something criminal that would have made it impossible for them to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
We all had interesting stories as to how we ended up there, and I think that's part of that perfect storm format. We had guys who didn't read that well. We had guys who didn't think that well. But we made for an interesting cast of characters. Matter of fact, we were there for a reunion in 08 and took a picture from back in the day. And here we were at the height of the Black Power movement. All of us took a photo of us standing on top of a tank. I don't know what message we were trying to send, but it let folks know, whoever saw the picture, that we were focused on a number of things. And we still had time to take time out for the Black Power movement as such.
Mm-hmm.
And to show our anger and outrage and all that in one.
So once you finished there, did you immediately return to New York? Did you strike off to go somewhere else to seek your fame and fortune?
Well,
what did you do?
Well, actually, stay at a place long enough, you become part of that. No matter how much you try to resist, you become part of it because it's your home away from home. So when I came home, what I found the first time was that I was no longer considered to be a New Yorker. I was now like a visitor because I was told I didn't talk the same. I developed the same issues that white folks had with coming into black neighborhoods. That was a little surprising. In other words, if you've ever seen whites who come to black neighborhoods, they're a little overly cautious. They're uncomfortable. Things that we may have adjusted to over the years, I had to readjust to. I mean, I had lost the whole concept that in our neighborhoods, you're going to find a lot of people with guns. You're going to find people coming to you every day telling you some tragic story, but in Nebraska, I never heard of that. Never heard of anything crazy going on. But once you come back home to the urban center, welcome back to the land of crazy. And it took me a long time to readjust to that until someone actually broke it down and told me, said, this is all part of it. Because you are transitioning from one place to another and then reversing it, coming back again. Some point in time, everybody can't work that well with that balance.
Did you return to New York, or did you, say, go to Camden or go to Philadelphia or go Detroit or Chicago or someplace else like that?
I had some, I guess you could say, some very good professors out there at Dome who advised a lot of us on what we could do and what we should do. And once I decided I was going to pursue the area of education, I'd given a lot of advice, and I had never considered going to grad school. That was unheard of. And then one education professor told me, said, you know, if you're thinking about going back east, Temple University has a very good program. So I said, well, why not? I got nothing to lose. So I applied to Temple, and then I headed back home because I needed some place to stay where the rent was free. And so I made it. That was an easy conversion there. I went back home, and my family had moved from Menford Place, and they were now at in the West Bronx, which was no place seemed comfortable to me anymore in New York. That's when I realized that I had lost the edge I used to have. I was kind of like I don't know if you remember the early westerns of the 60s and late 50s, like Have Gun, Will Travel?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay. Well, Have Gun, Will Travel worked on the concept that this guy, Paladin, he was always on the alert because his job was he was a hired killer. And when I came back, everything that I had learned over all those years, I no longer felt anymore. So I was just like a stranger in my homeland. It was crazy. So I knew I had to do something different, and people told me what Philadelphia was like. But I said, you know, it doesn't matter. It's another urban center. So I came to Philadelphia once I had gotten accepted by Temple. And I think I left early one morning, took the train down here to Philadelphia. And part of their program, their grad program, was that, and I don't know if they have any more like this, they pretty much guaranteed you a job. And didn't take much of my father to say, go do it. If they guarantee you a job and you had to get your master's through them to take it. So that's how I ended up down here, and their job, they sent me to Camden.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So Camden never was that crazy to me. Camden seemed to be a welcome relief from New York. Certainly a lot slower. That was another adjustment I had to make to move back to New York. Everything was moving too fast for me. So I came to Camden. Camden was probably just about the right speed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now you were secondary or you were elementary?
Secondary.
Okay.
Secondary.
So you went directly to the high school then, right?
Yep, went right to the high school. Actually, I did my student teaching at Camden High School. I was there for the first summer that I came into Camden.
Oh, okay.
So I went through all the craziness of that. That was an experience there because little did I know that here was a city, a small city with was overcrowded, and the two high schools were totally different. It was like two different African villages,
mm-hmm.
where you knew it was two villages within one. In other words, all the people claimed to be Camden residents, but they spoke a different language, they had a different perspective on life in the city, and they didn't consider themselves to be of the same vintage, the same clan. They saw themselves as being different. So rather than say they're Camdenites, they said, we're Camden High, and we're Woodrow Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they described mm-hmm. themselves.
Okay. So then you stayed in that system for 36 years.
Yeah.
Now, you retired. What prompted you to write the book? To get into writing?
Well, the book was perhaps an afterthought or it was coming back to some things I'd considered before, because a number of students over the years had said, you know, you should write a book, you should write a book, you know, got a lot of stories, a lot of information, and that sort of thing.
Now, clarify this. Were you an English teacher, or you were...
History.
History, okay. Mm.
And then 1 year, I had a substitute. He and I used to sit there and talk in the lounge. And he came to me one day and said, you know, I've been thinking about writing a book. So I said, go ahead and do it. And fast forward that several years down the road, he's a published author of, I think he has 6 or 7 books. Marcus Major. He writes romance, I guess you could call them romance novels, but his are a little more intriguing than the standard bearer romance novels. Not like a Danielle Steele or someone like that. But at the same time, he doesn't really write about erotica.
Oh, okay.
Because everyone sees that as being the, but his, what I like about his books is that you definitely need a dictionary as you read the stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they have, I've read, I think, 3 or 4 of them. They have great plots.
Okay. Now, you chose to write almost an autobiographical piece about growing up in the Bronx. It's entitled Life Lessons on Becoming a Young Man. Where can people get copies of your book?
Larry Miles Bookstore on 6th Street in Camden. And there are 2 different outfits carrying them also, 2 other outfits. One is a company out of Florida called Famaco, F-A-M-A-C-O. Famaco actually carries the book. I guess one of the co-owners had actually contacted me. And lo and behold, I said, it was really strange because as it turned out, he's actually a former student of mine.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
And I said, that was interesting, and he wrote a nice piece. I thought he wrote a very nice piece he put online about the book.
Oh, so he did a review of the book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, do you do e-commerce? You have a website? Can people go to, like, Barnes & Noble or Amazon and get copies?
Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon.com, yeah. They have it, too. Wow.
So you've been out promoting the book. What's that been like?
That's a wonderful experience. It was part of the time I talked to folks about how it wasn't that difficult to do. I think it took me just under a year to pull it all together. The hardest part was trying to determine whether to write a fictional piece or something that was more of a non-fictional variety. After I started writing it, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't much choice there, because I thought it was more value to young folks reading something that's not fiction. And I think that it's just a matter of preference, how you feel about it. Because the way I was thinking was that if they look at it and you tell them, this is just a story that a guy wrote about, now, then they can assume from that, oh, it's just a story, you know. And to their way of thinking, in a lot of cases, oh, it's make-believe. It didn't really happen. I also could have chose to go with based on a true story. I said, there's nothing harmful here. The vocabulary in there is such that it's something that works well at churches. I presented a piece of this book before I finished it at a few churches. And that's when I found out it played very well at the churches, because I guess for a number of reasons. The lack of profanity, there's no profanity in the book. The story seemed to work well. When I did it at one church, it was done at a Women's Day program, and the women afterwards had a lot of comments and said they liked the arrangement of it, and they felt that it would work well with a middle school group.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did one of my signings downtown at Larry Miles Bookstore, he told me that, and some teachers over there said they thought it would do very well with a high school group, because I've got a few coaches that I've met over the years that are interested in using it with their team.
Mm-hmm. Now, how can people get a hold of you in terms of for book signings and maybe for lectures or seminars?
Right now, I'm not finished developing this website, but right now they can get a hold of me by my email. And I don't know, do you have my email address? Secondary Ed Services.
Okay. Secondary Ed Services at yahoo.com.
At yahoo.com.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Do you offer group discounts and bulk purchase rates?
Well, I'm amenable to everything. I haven't had a book, a bulk situation come up yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
saying like
to work out terms on that.
Yeah, but I'm saying for like a book club, a readers club, a mentors group, Boy Scouts or something like that, because the book is about, it's called Life Lessons on Becoming a Young Man.
Right.
And so I'm just trying to put out there the various options that you might want to consider. So maybe you might want to think about it, because there may be some people that have groups that they would recommend this book to. And
mm-hmm.
they'd have to get copies of it either in the school or in for the club or the churches, whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm trying to go to churches, and right now I'm working with a Methodist group, through some Methodist ministers I met. I'm trying to get that done.
Mm-hmm. Now that it's finished and you're marketing it, you like talking about it. How is that working? I mean, do you see yourself going beyond the one-on-one, pressing the flesh, the book signings, to even something larger in terms of using the technology to market the book?
Oh, I would say so, because I've done two book fairs, and I'm actually in contact now with, I guess it's the NJEA, New Jersey Education
mm-hmm.
Association,
mm-hmm.
and trying to get picked up for their convention next year.
Oh, okay. All right. A friend of mine he self-published a book, and he's now in negotiation with the Philadelphia public library system to get them to,
mm-hmm.
and they've agreed to purchase some books to put them in the various branches. Is that something that you've considered, you know, not just for Camden, but say some of the other municipalities throughout South Jersey and around the country?
Yeah, I have some acquaintances, I don't know if they're quite friends yet, but they're out there and they're promoting their books, and I'm trying to see how that works, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've got someone actually who's in the theater realm of things, and he has suggested that he felt that it might work well as a play. I said, okay, I hadn't thought of that, but just tell me more. Tell me where you see it going from there. So he wanted permission to put it out there to several people that he works with and see if they would find or have an interest in something like this here. And so I've gotten a wide variety of responses to it. For instance, something I hadn't even considered, I was told there is an organization that they have some sort of situation regarding the cover of books, book covers. And I don't know if it's a competition or whatever, but they said they thought the cover itself merits some consideration for being viewed as something that should be put up for, I guess, a competition because of the cover. And I had some artists tell me that the cover is unusual, and they asked me, how did I come up with the cover? I said, actually, the publisher asked me to submit some pictures, and she said that she liked, she's artistically inclined. She said she liked the fact that this picture on the front, it seemed to do a lot for the book.
The people on the book, is that your mother and father?
Yes.
Mm, okay. Yeah, because you know, it has the sepia type picture, you know, the color in it. So that's unique. So it's not something that we see every day. And so it's very eye catching.
The picture was taken in 1947.
Yeah, but I'm just saying the sepia color, the picture was in vogue back then, that style, but it's not now, so it makes it very eye-catching.
And the border of the book, that picture there was taken in 1956.
Now, where is that?
That's in the Bronx. That's actually taken from the window of the Forest Project.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
That's one of those pictures that, oddly enough, I took that picture. I find that amazing. I was 6 and a half when I took the picture. On the back cover, it's actually a picture of a 1950s, looks like a late 50s, either Buick, or might even be a Cadillac. It's got the fishtails on the back.
Yeah, or maybe either a Buick or a Chevy or something. I think it's a Buick.
Mm-hmm. Across the street, at the top of the back cover, it's actually an elementary school. So there's a lot of history there.
What do you plan on doing as a follow-up? I mean, in addition to marketing this, you plan on doing something else?
Well, I had started on that about 4 months ago, actually. That was more accidental than anything else, because when my publisher explained to me how many words or how many pages I needed before she would consider following through with the book, I actually wrote, shall we say, more than enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got right now about 8 vignettes left that were never used. So I said, well, that was a good thing, because at least it gave me a lead in to another book. And at one of the signings, I got some feedback from the audience, and they said, well, they were wondering whether I was, when you say a follow up, whether it was going to be a continuation, almost like Life Lessons Book 2.
Mm-hmm.
Because they felt that there were some things that it left an area for a lot more to be said. And I said, well, that's certainly possible. It's certainly something I could consider. And I was thinking in terms of knowing that I had so many left. And like my publisher said, she said, well, if you got that many left, you know, we can start from there if you want and see what we can do with that. So I intend to have another book done before this year's end.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you going to continue on this vein, but talk about, you know, your career as an educator? Or what do you anticipate being in the
book? Well, I've got a lot of possible directions to go, because a lot of people that I've known over the years thought that I was going to write about my experiences as an educator. I said that was too easy. That was too easy because it's I guess it's something that I heard an author say not too long ago. I don't know, a female author. She said, when you're writing, what happens, you have to let it all come to you. So it's not really a case where you say, okay, I'm going to write about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Especially if you have so many storylines and so many things to consider. I've spent many nights literally doing that before I realized that's how this process works. You have a lot of ideas you would like to do, but as you sit and you've got no one else to consider in helping you to get past or through this, you sit there and just do a lot of thinking. And this is what came to me, was the idea about these early lessons that I had learned as a young person. Now I have to see whether I'm truly through that or past that by now, since I know I have some that are already done, or do I want to continue with that? But I'm looking forward to getting to the point to talk about the experience as an educator. And the other thing that I've already figured out, too, I don't like to do anything that's all that serious. So whatever I write about, it's going to have to be something where there's some humor.
Yeah,
there.
Some levity in it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually found that out at one of the readings where some of the women were there found things humorous that I didn't think were that humorous.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to ask them later, well, you know, I don't know how best to say this, but could you tell me what you found so funny? Because I must have missed the point. And they had a completely different perspective on things that I thought were more serious. And one of the women explained, she said, no, I said, you thought, or you, forgot that you were reading to women, and we found humor in what you were saying, whereas the male audience might not have.
Plus, you were offering them a peek inside the process of a male growing up, coming
exactly.
of age, you know. Yeah.
Exactly.
We're almost out of time. Give us your email again, and so folks can contact you for any follow-up questions or any information about this book. It's entitled Life Lessons on Becoming a Young Man. Give us your email contact information, and then we'll let you go with our gratitude.
Okay. The email is secondaryedservices@yahoo.com.
Okay. All right. We've been talking to Stanley Ash, who's a retired educator, and his book is entitled Life Lessons on Becoming a Young Man, and we appreciate him being with us here today. Our guest was Stanley Ash, former educator, school administrator, former athletic director. He's an author. His first book, Life Lessons on Becoming a Young Man. The ISBN number is -13:978-1928681-23-6, in case you go to the library and want to take it out. For more information on Stanley Ash, you can email him at Secondary Ed Services, SecondaryEdServices, @yahoo.com. You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. My name is Junius Ricardo Stanton, and in closing, we wish each and every one of you love, peace, health, prosperity, wisdom, power, but most of all, courage. The courage to find meaning, purpose, and fulfillment in your life so that you evolve into all that the Creator intends for you to be, and your life manifests magnificently. As a spiritual being, having a wholesome and productive life on this material plane. And as always, engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind. The rest will follow.
Cyberspace is a place that no army with artillery invades. Where no military.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
That no corporation